Hi, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Siebel, and boy, oh boy, have we got some interesting things to share with you today, especially if you're like me, you get overwhelmed with technology. When people start talking about new stuff, your heart starts to go up into your throat. You can't breathe. You go, I don't know if I can take this. Well, we've got a guest today that's going to be sharing some interesting things with us. Before we go to Bob, and who is in Seattle, Washington, we are going to be giving out our phone number so that you can write it down for later on in the hour. And these are toll-free numbers, 877-876-5227. And from Canada, 888-810-8322. Now, remember, with the Donna Siebel Show, you always want to have that pad of paper and pen or pencil handy because you're going to want to write down some information that we're going to be sharing with you. And I want to introduce Bob Seidensticker. He has a book called Future Hype, The Myths of Technology Change. Bob, welcome from Seattle.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm so delighted to have you on the show. And when I was talking a moment ago about hearing more stuff about technology and it gets to be overwhelming, you can't feel like you can't breathe, I've had that experience with people when they get into this high-tech mode. And it really, really seems like it's just a little bit too much to bear. But you've been involved with technology since you were just a little shaver. When did you first define that this was going to be where you wanted to be involved in your life?
I think it was probably in the mid-70s. I was in a summer program, and we had an IBM 1130. It was a kind of a small mainframe computer, and we used punch cards, and I was in love from that point. It was I really didn't turn back after that point.
Now, you graduated from MIT with a degree in computer science, and MIT is such a prestigious school, and you designed digital hardware. And you wrote your first book in 1986, and it was called The Well-Tempered Digital Design. You have worked in all kinds of computer languages in various environments, and you know all about the punch cards that were out so long ago. And you've been involved in so many different companies, mega sizes to little bitty ones. What was the specific accomplishment in 1986? You say it's the PC Dark Ages. What were those Dark Ages, and what did you do?
Well, I think when you look at the PC, you find a burst of innovation with the Apple II in the late 70s. You had the IBM PC. This is the 25th anniversary, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1981. And I was doing digital hardware during that time and quickly moved over to software, Windows, that sort of thing. I think what you can see is where we have quite a bit of innovation. When you get more toward the current age, I think you're seeing the real rate of change slowing down quite a bit. And in fact, one thing that I find fascinating is I think probably all of your listeners are aware of Moore's Law, the observation that computer power doubles every couple of years. It's really been going strong for about
mm-hmm.
40 years. But what is changing now is that is now being applied not to more computing power, which we couldn't get enough of up to, you know, at least perhaps a decade ago or so, and now is being switched to give us more battery life, those sorts of things. So, yeah, even the companies themselves, Intel, AMD, Dell, that sort of thing, realize that computing power is pretty much more than what we need. And things like battery life, mundane things like that, are now taking the fore. So I see a strong maturing trend in the computer industry.
You have so many neat quotes, and this one I liked. It says, when you get the urge to predict the future, better lie down until the feeling goes away. And that was in Forbes magazine
in
1978.
If only people would apply that more often. I mean, you know, when you think about trying to imagine turning the clock back 40 years and asking them, you know, did they underestimate the PC and the internet? They didn't. That wasn't the problem. They didn't estimate it at all. It wasn't even on the radar screen. And that's the problem that we have looking 40 years or even 20 years into our own future. So I think it's a quite a bit of hubris when people seem to see with absolute clarity what's going to happen way down the road. I think we've had so many examples, so many mistakes. You know, the path is littered with these failed predictions. We need to take stock of that and remember that next time we hear about the next big thing.
Technology, I think, has always fascinated people. Most individuals I do not find, and I have to include myself in the group, so this is my paradigm of view, are not necessarily particularly wanting to be the inventor. They're not technologically oriented like in the design factor, but they get so excited about having a new toy. And that's not new. Right at the very beginning of your book, you relate a wonderful story about chess in India 1,400 years ago. Would you share that with my audience? Because I think it is just such a marvelous example of what we're like as people, and we haven't really changed as human beings all that much.
Quite so, and part of the challenge is it's sort of like statistics or some of these puzzles that we really should understand better, but we just don't have an intuitive grasp of these things. The story that you mentioned, the one about chess, is there was an inventor of chess, and he presented it to the local lord, king, whatever. And the king was so delighted by this new military game that he granted the inventor anything he wanted. You know, you name it, you got it, I'm the king, I can provide this. And so the inventor said, okay, my request is very modest. All I want is one grain of rice for the first square. I want two grains of rice for the second square. I want four for the next square, and so on, doubling with each square. That's all I ask. And the king says, you know, if that's it, you're pretty easy to please, no problem. But when you actually add it up, we're talking about 64 squares here. So 2 to the 64th grains, when you get to the end, that's an awful lot of rice. And it turns, when you compute it, it's about 300 billion tons more rice than has been harvested in the history of humanity. So I'm not sure how it actually happened.
How that right.
how the inventor was eventually satisfied, or maybe he was just, you know, put away somewhere to make him be quiet. But that's a challenge that we have. I mean, just we are like the king, where we you know, a few doublings. I mean, you know, how much can it matter? And yet, when we have the case of Moore's law, you look at the primitive, the laughably primitive microprocessors in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, and you know, we're still doubling every couple of years, and it really adds up to a lot of stuff. So that I think is one side of it, and unfortunately that's the only side that I think we really focus on. That this is really amazing. I think getting a little bit further down the road, when you think about it, Moore's law is amazing, but it's only amazing.
Well, you bring out a number of very good points, and for those of you who are just tuning in, we're talking about future heights. The myths of technological change, or as it's on his book, Technology Change. And Bob Seidensticker is my guest today. Bob, when we look at all of the various computer aspects that are available to us now, there are so many hundreds of different software programs. I know a number of people in the industry that are involved in programming just like you are. They work for major companies. And whenever one of these programs come out, it is a nightmare because they have to go in before it's even supposed to go out to the public and correct all of these bugs, and there's a gazillion bugs that are in it, and then they find they don't have enough time to get out but maybe half of the gazillion bugs, so they still have a half a gazillion to go through, and then once it hits the market, they're still working out the bugs even more. It is almost a nightmare. Why did you feel you needed to write the book about the myths? You're in this industry. You love it. Why did you feel you wanted to bring these myths to the forefront?
You're right. I do love it. I'm not coming at this from a Luddite standpoint. That is, I'm not saying shouldn't we turn the clock back and be like our grandparents or, you know, great-grandparents. That's not the idea at all. Technology can do some amazing things. What disturbs me, what troubles me, is when we are deceived by these technology myths, and these are things like the idea that technology is changing faster and faster, that it's exponential, that's a myth, that it's inevitable, it's sure to happen, that's a myth, that today's technology is so impressive that it eclipses all that came before, that's also a myth. So to answer your question, I as I kind of matured, I guess, and sort of saw technology from a bigger picture, more than just my own small area, I saw that while Moore's Law and a few things like that are really doing all kinds of amazing things, both good and bad, in the computer industry, that is not true for most industries. If you look at energy, for example, or transportation or civil engineering, these are pretty mature industries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, they have had their own day in the sun, and maybe they will again. But energy, for example, electricity in the I guess 1880s, we had nuclear power in the 50s and 60s. The light, the flame burns brighter for a bit, and then it sort of goes back down to a pilot light.
Mm-hmm.
That's the challenge we have. In the 30s, we had Hoover Dam, Golden Gate Bridge, Empire State Building. We had some amazing surges forward, and then that just became kind of the status quo. Even going back as far as the printing press in the late 1400s, you know, going from having to write this by hand to ka-chunk, 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 you know, every 5-10 seconds, however long it takes, a new page, an entire page comes out.
Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing change. But then after about 1500, that technology was just kind of part of the landscape. It sort of permeated all of Europe. It had its impact. And then again in the 1820s and 30s, a new revolution. You had the steam presses. They increased the production rate by a factor of 100 over the manual presses. So again, if you look at the entire landscape of technology, you see this spotlight is the way I like to think of it. Spotlight shining on this technology for 2, 3, 4 decades, and then it fades away, and then it goes over there, and that's what we've been seeing for the past 200 years.
You make a statement in your book, asking whether a computer can think or wonder is like asking whether a car can trot or gallop. A computer has its own way of operating, which may be quite different from the human approach. The most efficient machines usually don't mimic how humans or animals work. There is a dramatic word, paranoia, about computers taking over the world. And we have so many people whose jobs have been eliminated with robotic machines. And through the utilization of our technologies we have it available today, we have been able to make some shifts and changes in dealing with business and dealing with manufacturing on different levels, all kinds of things. There is a fear that is there regarding robotics, computer intelligence, we're going to just be replaced by all these machines. What's your positioning on this? You're right in line in the industry. Is this one of the myths that you see being perpetuated?
Not really. I mean, one can't disagree with the fact that people's lives are changing in many cases. In some industries, jobs are being shipped overseas or being replaced by automation, that sort of thing. And yet, let's keep in mind again how that idea has changed over the past 30 years or so. 30 years ago or so, if you asked what the current pulse of the nation was, it was that our jobs would be replaced by robots. You know, it was obvious. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you look at the changes, the innovation. We had these kind of big industrial robots in car companies. It was going to just expand from there. You know, huge swaths of the economy were going to be replaced. And that, I think, is a great lesson where some jobs have been lost, not by robots. So, you know, you couldn't call that a win, a correct
mm-hmm.
prediction at all, because it was, you know, where the challenge was coming from was not at all from the right place. But this idea of jobs changing, being eliminated, transforming from industry A to industry B, it goes back to one example that comes to mind is Edison. The candle makers were picketing his company because light bulbs would put them out of work.
Yes.
Now, yes, okay, fine, there are a small number of candle makers who would be affected, but a huge number of jobs would be created. So, you know, in that case, the big picture was a fairly happy one. And you know, hopefully we can find, as things change around here, we'll find some things are shutting down, new opportunities are opening up. In the area of artificial intelligence, you know, being replaced by
mm-hmm.
robots, that sort of thing, that may well come to pass, but that, I think, is one of the areas where the predictions have been most wrong. In 97, we saw the world chess champion was finally a computer, and yet we must remember that was 10 years away since the 50s. And artificial intelligence, the idea of HAL the computer has been, you know, we've been kind of on the verge of that, you know, for
mm-hmm.
decades. And so artificial intelligence is an exciting field. I actually did a little bit of work of that at MIT myself. So I personally, it's very exciting. But again, if we take any lesson from history, we must remember that this area in particular has been very much overpromised. So here again, I think is an issue. One last thought on this.
Sure.
If you want some real change, some real impact in the society and the economy, look at the Industrial Revolution. I mean, the changes we have, and I'm not going to minimize them or downplay the challenge it can place on people whose jobs have been changed. You know, that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of impact on the economy, you look at people who go in a generation from life being self-sufficient in a farm to life, to the entire family moving into a filthy, industrial, noisy city, 6 days a week working in factory jobs. That is a big change. And, you know, if you, to sort of respond to people who see change increasing exponentially, if that is anything, you could almost see change as decreasing, because, you know, nothing that we have right now compares to the Industrial Revolution. And of course, it wasn't a small little backwater in England. This was pretty much the entire country.
Yes, it was. Let's talk about struggling with technology. I was jokingly, but not really joking, about how it can just be overwhelmed. You walk into any one of these stores that carry all kinds of computer equipment, and you feel like you are in a no man's land of confusion, because here are all these tools and toys that have all of this computerized application, and people will say, and I've got a very good friend that he's just in his glory whenever he goes into a store like Radio Shack or a Sharper Image or something like this, because he said, I love all the toys. Even though he's had a toy for maybe 2 years, it's like, I got to go in and get another one, whether it's a telephone or something else. He just absolutely loves it. But most people struggle with upgrades and change, and you have a very good section on, or in your book, that talks about the story of new computer users who, when told during the installation process to type any key, complained they couldn't find the any key.
Right.
And it's a whole new language, isn't it, when people are getting involved there. Does that have very much to do with the market, with the changes in the market? I mean, are companies just producing this equipment because they want to be the new kid on the block with a new toy? Or are they really thinking about the consumers and what the consumers want?
Well, of course, when you have an example like the iPod, where Apple generates, you know, a new flavor of the iPod every few months and people just eat it up, other companies say, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I want to do. And the challenge from the consumer standpoint is, you know, for every iPod, every really successful thing that the people say, okay, this makes sense, I get it, it serves a need, I'm going to fork over the money for this, there are, you know, a dozen that flop for one reason or another. One example is the Segway. You remember that two-wheeled vehicle that was supposed to revolutionize personal transportation? Very cool technology, really exciting stuff. I don't know if you've had a chance to try one, but I have, and it's really impressive. But it didn't meet whatever need it was shooting for. So, you know, very exciting. But, you know, again, we need to anticipate that most new products fail. That's, you know, if history is any lesson, that's what we see. Ask any entrepreneur. He's going to tell you that from the light bulb over your head through the lab to a product in the marketplace, through that into something that the majority of people use, lots of attrition. You know, very few products make it that way. And, you know, we as users are the guinea pigs. We're mm-hmm. the ones we're the test market. Someone throws out something and see if it sticks to the wall. So that's one of the things that I'm trying to mention, trying to raise the point in the book. You mentioned your friend who loves gadgets. Now, if that's a person who, this is not a money issue, he's got the money, the disposable income to spend on this, and he enjoys it, that's terrific. That's just great. What concerns me is someone who feels obliged to do this. And you mentioned before the challenge, not the opportunity, but the challenge of learning a new program. You know, okay, gang, we in our division are going to now use this new scheduling program, and it's going to make us so much more efficient and productive and whatever. And you know, and I'm thinking, I got to learn this stupid thing. I got to, you know, spend, you know, 5-10 hours either with a manual or just kind of bumbling through myself, being unproductive to learn this thing. And, you know, yes, there are upsides when you've got an iPod and something that's cool and exciting, but there's also a downside measured both in frustration and time when it comes to either your personal time or the time the company is paying you to be on the job.
That is so true. I think of the gentleman, Don, who is engineering all of our equipment. He has, over the past few months, worked with so many different programs, and it just, I'm surprised he's not white-haired, because lots of times he finds things are not compatible, it takes him hours to be able to bring something into harmony, and sometimes he just has to toss what he has thought was going to be absolutely marvelous because it's just not going to do what needs to be done. This is such a challenge for anyone at any time. And in your book, you say only people born before a technology becomes pervasive. Think of it as a technology. All others consider it part of the environment. That's technological myopia. And I thought that was such a fun statement for you to make. We would never think of ourselves as being myopic as far as technology goes.
But it's something, as you mentioned, that we all experience this notion that the younger generation, they live in a sea of this technology, whatever the technology is at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and they're very conversant in it, no problem. I mean, how would you do things any other way?
Mm-hmm.
And those black plastic things that would break that you had sound from, I mean, you know, they're fascinated by these by an older technology when from our standpoint, an iPod is pretty darn cool. So we have that, and I think the myopia challenge is one that we, you know, when we were those kids, we, you know, had things like cars were not at all new. They were part of the landscape. But when we look back, I think that the myopia takes effect when we look back and we dismiss the technology from the past. And one of my kind of smaller motivations was imagining someone of like my mother's generation who lived through quite a lot. And
mm-hmm.
and I think to have the buzz of the moment tell someone of her generation, you know, what you lived through really counts for nothing. I mean, if you want change, how about the internet? How about the iPod? How about the PC? And I'm thinking, you know, okay, someone who was born in, let's say, 1930, lived through radio, lived through TV, lived through black, lived through color TV, space program, nuclear power, you know, big, big changes. You can look at just about any time period between, you know, from now and 200 years ago back to the Industrial Revolution and find as much change as you have today.
I think that's very true. And I agree with your premise that we stand on the shoulders of the people that have gone before us. I'm trying to think. I came across some material the other day. There was a computer that was invented by the Greeks that was discovered not all that long ago, and people thought, no, this isn't possible. These people couldn't possibly have invented anything like a computer. But they did. They did do it in their own fashion, in their own way, and so many of the mathematicians at that time, most of them ended up dying at a relatively early age, but when we're looking at what they had done, they said, wow, they could have been where we are if they'd just been given a little bit more time, you know, different opportunities. And that is what's so fascinating about this, because there's always the thinkers out there. There are always the people that say, I wonder how I can do this better.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, the example that comes to mind for me is the example of the Roman Empire, where they had the aqueducts, they had the civil engineering, just a huge flowering of technology
mm-hmm.
in that area. And they were the ones, a hero of Alexandria, had this first steam toy. I imagine many of your listeners have seen examples of it. It was a ball with a little spigot pointing in one direction, on the other side pointing in the other direction.
Yes.
When steam went in, it would spin around really fast. It was just a toy. And this was in about the year 100, more or less. And the observation someone mentioned, which I think was fascinating, was because Romans had slavery, they had a problem with idle hands. So the idea of a labor-saving machine was kind of a crazy idea. I mean, we have a surplus of labor. Who'd want to save labor?
Mm-hmm.
So the bizarre thing was, if they didn't have slavery, and if they were saying, oh, man, if we only had, you know, 20 more hands here, we could really increase productivity. We could make some more money, more trade, all kinds of cool things. Maybe we'd have this Industrial Revolution, you know, 1,000-plus years ago. Fascinating concepts.
Oh, they really are. They're absolutely incredibly fascinating. Because lots of times we get stuck in our little world, and unless we are reading or exploring or interacting with people from different environments, and especially when it comes to history, I think that makes history so rich and so valuable. Because if we are able to see and perceive, then we go, wow, then so-and-so thought of this, and then 100 years later someone else picked up on this because they read something on a piece of papyrus, and they said, ah, oh, and the light goes off in their brain cells, And it just keeps moving forward. And sometimes things, the same kind of thinking is going on in different parts of the world, and people weren't even aware that someone in South America was thinking the same way that the guy in Manhattan in New York was thinking, or in the middle of Paris, France. It's amazing that today we are able to communicate a lot more rapidly and a lot more efficiently than ever before.
Actually, as I wrote the book, I was sort of torn in two directions. One was looking at some of these fascinating historical precedents, which made the whole topic very rich and very live for me. And the other thing was just seeing people today, and in my mind, being duped by some of these technology myths. And as I got into it more, it occurred to me that we as consumers are often being the downside is the hidden costs.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so often we think of just the capital cost and not a big deal, ignoring the time we spend trying to learn how these things work, the time we spend trying to make them work. I mean, you know, why is this why is my internet not working? Why is this printer not working? That kind of thing. You know, this is not calling in the repair guy. This is we ourselves spending time which has value, trying to push through this kind of stuff. So there really are some hidden costs between due to today's technology.
Oh, no question about that. No question about that whatsoever. Well, my guest today has been Bob Seidensticker. His book, Future Hype, The Myths of Technology Change. There is so much good information in here, and trust me, I'm not a technologically oriented person. However, this book is easy to read and understand. And if you have someone in your family or a friend that really loves to know about technology, this is a very good book to read. Now, Bob, where is your website if people want to get more information about you, what you're doing, your book, etc.?
The website is future-hype.com, and it has articles, stories. It has some excerpts from the book, that sort of thing. And I expect to have a blog up there in about 2 weeks.
Ooh. So for those of you who are computer savvy, if blog is your thing, then you're not going to want to miss interacting with Bob Seidensticker. Now, let me spell his name. It's Seidensticker. He's located in Seattle, Washington. His website is future-hype.com. Bob, thanks ever so much for being my guest. Your book was fascinating and filled with a lot of good information.
Thank you, Donna.
Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
This is Donna Sebo. We are taking a break. When we come back, well, we'll have the opportunity to chat. Here are the toll-free numbers to call in, 2-877-876-5227, or toll-free, again, from Canada, 888-810-8322. And, again, this is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be coming back. Don't forget Bob Seidensticker's website, future-hype.com. Must see. Fascinating stuff. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't you go away now. Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and if you'd like to call in and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, here are our toll-free numbers, 877-876-5227, and then 888-810-8322. We also have a direct dial-in line of 530-876-9146. And we will be taking your calls if you should decide you would like for me to give you that little bit of insight that you might need for this day. Also, I want to remind you, this month I am going to be appearing in Fairbanks and Anchorage, Alaska, as well as in New York City. And if you or a friend would like to meet with me in person while I'm there, I'm also going to be available by telephone. Call my office at 800-872-8852, and then we can set up appointments there. I'm going to be doing an appearance at the National Publicity Summit while I'm in New York, and that's an opportunity that I've been able to enjoy more than once over the past few years, and I will be meeting like well over 100 authors from all over the country, and some people even fly in from outside of the country to be able to participate in this phenomenal event because of the opportunity to interact with people in the broadcasting medium. So if you want all the particulars, etc., go into my website. My webmaster, Carol, she has put all the stuff up there. So you've got my newsletter you can go to, and the website is DelphiInternational.com. Delphi, just like the Oracle, D-E-L-P-H-I, International.com. And go in there on the front page. You'll see all the buttons to your right. And don't forget, stop by and visit the button that says glyconutrients on it. Some fascinating nutritional information that I think could make a difference in your life. Well, just a little bit of a light thought regarding diet. And if you're like so many of us, we're always trying to keep ourselves trim, right? We don't want to be fat and sloppy, so we just try so hard and we're so good, and maybe we pick a diet or two. Well, I have an attitude about diets. I don't like them. But anyway, maybe you overdo, okay? Maybe you suddenly find that you have a craving for that banana split that you have not had for a year and a half, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, the bananas, the whipped cream, the chocolate, the strawberry, and the vanilla ice cream are calling to you. So you go out and you have one, and then afterwards you go, oh, I should never have eaten it. Oh, terrible, terrible, terrible. Well, hey, get a grip. You know, we're all going to do something like that every once in a while. There's nobody that's going to be exempt from sliding down the slide of overindulgence periodically. So if you do that, don't beat yourself up, for heaven's sakes. What you do is look back at your last weight loss success. Maybe you dropped 2 pounds. I know the banana split weighs 5. It's okay. Just understand that you're going to be able to go ahead and get back to where you want to be. It's not the end of the world. And also, if you really want to be aware of how you're eating and what you're eating, I think of people that I've known over the years that have carried abnormally large amounts of weight. And when they actually kept a food diary of what they were taking in, many of the foods like crackers and things that had high amounts of fat in them, high carbs, it was something they didn't realize how much they were eating. Have you ever heard the commercial, I bet you can't eat just one, it was for a particular potato chip? Well, that's not a joke for a lot of people with different foods. You're not just going to have one piece of a potato chip or just one little corn chip or maybe just one cookie. Now, if you've got the will and constitution of the universe behind you, I guess you can do that. But most of us aren't. Many times we get busy and we're in a hurry. We're always so busy. So we're just putting stuff into our face, so to speak, and we're scrunching it down. And before we know it, it's all gone. And we go, wow, did I really eat all of that? Yes, you did. So when you keep a food journal and you can write down what it is that you're taking in, often you'll find that you are eating because you're in a hurry, you're under a lot of stress, you get ravenously hungry and you just grab something and you're not getting full right away because you don't have a chance to relax and let your food start to digest. So you have that sensation of feeling full. I know, I've done the same thing. I've done the very same thing. And then 5 minutes later you go, boy, I feel like I ate an elephant. And you can't hardly keep your pants buttoned. Well, when you keep a food diary, you realize what you're doing to yourself, and that's sometimes a very good thing to do. Also, if you can join a support group, if you have some good buddies that you can interact with, that is really help. And what you need to do, if you have had, and I use the banana split as a silly example, but hey, it's as good as an example as any, don't get so intense that once you do that, then wow, you've got to go to the gym next day and really got to exercise and exercise and exercise and exercise because you want to burn up that 5,000 amount of calories. Well, it's not going to work the way you think. I know of a woman that whenever she has a dessert, she will be on her treadmill until 3 o'clock in the morning until she knows that she's burned that exact amount of calories. This person is so close to being anorexic, it's not even funny. And this is what this individual will do. And I thought, I don't think I'd be on the treadmill till 3 o'clock in the morning. One, it'd keep me awake for hours. But it's just amazing what we do. So, for heaven's sakes, don't starve yourself. The next day after you've had this time of indulgence, just use moderation. And because what will often happen is when we start starving ourselves, we feel like we're being deprived, and then we psychologically give ourselves a triple whammy. So enjoy your food. Have a good time with food. But remember, moderation is the key. And if you do overindulge, don't beat yourself up over it. If you're overindulging every single day, that's a different kettle of fish. But if you're just doing it once in a while, remember, you cannot live this life without the pleasure of delicious food and fun things in food. and that includes desserts. It's all a part of life. And when you deny yourself the privilege and joy of good food, you're really missing out on a lot of good things. I think that's my personal bias. I don't know about you, but I just absolutely enjoy when I have the opportunity to do so. Fixing good foods, whether it's a pot of soup or it is a cheesecake supreme, and sharing it with friends. It's not enough just to do it for myself. I've been this way ever since I was 17. Absolutely love to fix things and just to take them in and to share them with other people, because the fun was in the sharing. The fun was being able to fix what I wanted to fix and then pass it around and have a lot of people enjoy what I had prepared. Well, you know, I had mentioned soup. I don't know what the temps are like where you are, but here in the Pacific Northwest, they're getting cool. In fact, we were told by our weather service here, well, summer's gone. I think somebody at the weather service didn't pay attention, because we've really had some sunshine since they made that massive prediction. But the temps have dropped, and I don't know about you, but when you start getting a feeling of crispness in the air, if you enjoy cooking the way I do, it's like, what can I fix? Well, baking fresh bread is always good, but how about a nice pot of soup? Well, if your schedule is busy and you're going 10,000 miles an hour and you don't have a lot of time to fiddle with food, the crock pot is a godsend in the kitchen. And I came across a wonderful beef and cabbage soup recipe that you could prepare, put it on, set it on low, go to work, take the kids to the games, do whatever you're going to do, and when it's time for having dinner, and even if you have members of the family coming in at different times, it's in the crock pot, it's ready to serve, and oh, when you take the lid off, the fragrance that goes through the house, maybe I should say aroma. Oh, we can't beat it. It's wonderful. Okay, this makes about 8 servings, and this is just so easy. Now, you need 2/3 of a pound of ground beef. I'm not real fond of ground beef myself. This is just my personal prejudice. I like to have, like, chuck. So I will cut up chuck, and that's just me. If you like ground beef, then use the lean, whatever is your pleasure. And then you take a medium onion, and you want to chop that up. You need a 40-ounce can of tomatoes, and you need 2 cups of water, and then you need a 15-ounce can of kidney beans, 1/2 teaspoon of pepper, 1 tablespoon of chili powder. Of course, if you don't want chili powder, you don't have to have it in there. But 1 tablespoon of chili powder, 1/2 cup of chopped celery, and 2 cups of thinly sliced cabbage. Now, if you have your ground beef, you're going to want to saute that beef first before you put it in the crock pot. And you're going to want to drain it, because your ground beef usually has a lot of water in it, some fatty. So just drain it out. Then you take all of the other ingredients, put them in the pot, and then you add your ground beef, if that's what you're using. If you're going to use chuck, which I prefer to use, just cut it up. Just cut your chuck pieces up and then put them in. If you want to brown them first, go ahead and brown them. If you don't want to brown them, just toss the meat in the crock pot. Put it all, except your cabbage. Don't put your cabbage in from the beginning. And you put it in your slow cooker, your crock pot. Let it cook 3-4 hours, whatever it is that it takes. And then you can add your cabbage, and you let the cabbage cook on low or maybe high. You could turn it on to high, and it's going to take 30 to 60 minutes to cook the cabbage. It'll cook very, very quickly right there. And cabbage has some moisture in it, too, so that'll add to the flavor of the soup. But you've got this. It's in your crock pot, and I'll tell you something. You can have some shredded cheese on the side if you like, or maybe even a little bit of sour cream. Use your imagination. And just have these things on the table. Ask the kids what they'd like to have with it. It's great. And there you have a wonderful meal. Have your fresh bread all ready to go. And maybe even a salad. And you are set. And everybody's happy, because it's quick, easy, and cleanup is a breeze. You know, I know one lady, when she gets busy with her family, she said what she has done, she has gotten so she has more paper plates than she does any china plates in the house and or bowls. So she said when she's really busy, everybody in the family knows, don't bother with the dishes. We don't even have time to wash. We'll use paper bowls or paper plates, things like this, or they even use big cups that enable them to put hot stuff in the cups. She said, we just want to make it simple, easy to clean up because we're all so busy with all the activities of the kids and everything going on with the family. So just a few tips to share with you. I hope you enjoy them. We're going to be taking a break in just a moment. I want to remind you that I am going to this month be in Fairbanks and Anchorage, Alaska. Also, I'm going to be in New York City. And if you want to check my itinerary, go ahead, go into my website, DelphiInternational.com. And if you'd be interested or know of someone that would be interested in meeting with me while I'm in any of those cities, all they have to do is call me at my office, 800-872-8852. Well, when we come back, we've got some good things to share with you. And if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of insight, here are the numbers. USA, 877-876-5227, or Canada, 888-810-8322. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Quickly, I know we have a caller waiting on the line. I want to remind those of you that are regular listeners and even those of you that are first-time listeners, please, if you have any comments regarding the programming, let us know what you've enjoyed. Then go to the BBS radio site, and there is a comment section, and we would just love to hear from you. Also, I would like to hear from you if you have a special recipe or a story that you would like to share. You know, in a few months, the holidays are going to be here, and sometimes people have some of the most wonderful things that they do for the holidays. I'm always interested in hearing your stories, and I enjoy sharing them with my listeners. So remember, you can send me an email at Donna@DelphiInternational. That's Donna@DelphiInternational.com. And I usually respond fairly quickly, but if I'm on the road traveling, be patient, follow up with me. If you don't hear from me within a little bit of time, maybe usually I respond within 24 to 48 hours, but just be patient, follow up with me, and I will let you know about your story or whether I'm going to be able to use it or not. I get so much wonderful stuff. I just am so pleased that you take the time to do that. Let's go to our first caller. I want to welcome you to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
E from Tacoma.
All right. And was that E or P? I couldn't hear you very well there.
Pardon?
Your initial one more time.
E.
Okay. I still didn't get it, but that doesn't make any difference.
E like in Elaine.
Oh, E like in Elaine. Okay, got it. All right. Now, E, what I'm looking at with you is a sense of frustration. I feel as if I have been banging my head against a brick wall. I don't know that I can make any changes the way I'd really like to see them made. This is how I'm perceiving things at the moment when I'm focusing on you. I want you to know you don't need to bang your head up against a brick wall. That's not a requirement. Of course, I'm just speaking of this figuratively. I just want you to be aware, though, that there is a need for you perhaps to do some brainstorming with some individuals that are a little bit different and how they look at things.
Can you repeat what you just said? I can barely hear you.
Okay, I don't know. We don't seem to have a real strong connection. But what I would say is you need to do some brainstorming with some people that you have, well, they think outside of the box. That's what I would like to describe them as doing. Because it's going to enable you as an individual to be able to see that you have some other options than what you have been aware of to this point in time. And I'm really fascinated with you because there is this appearance of everything being in very slow motion, or that's how you feel it is. And at the same time, you have this tremendous sense of overwhelming pressure, and as if I don't get everything done right now, I'm not going to be able to get anything done at all. Be aware that those two perceptions are what will be keeping you in balance. You do need to follow through and finish some particular areas of work that you need to finish. You need to get that done so that you can then have the freedom and flexibility to do some other things that mean a lot to you. That's so very, very important. But you've got to be able to do things in a timely manner, dear. You can't do everything all at once. So don't beat yourself up. Don't be hard on yourself. Just know that you've got to stay consistent so that you can get the results you really would like to have. And working with money is going to be a challenge for you. It's going to be a big challenge for you. But you're learning a lot, and you're learning how to work with money and to plan with money in ways and manners that you have not really considered before. So I think if I were to describe this year and the year 2007 coming up, I would call them aha years. And I say that because it's like you're going, oh, that's what I needed to pay attention to. Aha, that's what I need. So that's why I'm calling them the aha years. And after 2007, I think you pretty much will have paid your dues, and then in that way you're going to feel much more comfortable with where you'll be. But it's a learning curve. It's nothing good or bad. Did you have a question for me?
Yeah, you've described something I'm going through in my life, but my question is another thing. I always call you before I take a trip, and you've always given me the best advice ever, made the trip fun, and I haven't had problems because of you.
Oh, well, bless your heart.
Yeah. So I'm going on another trip, and so I thought I'd call you. My sister and I are going to meet my daughter who lives in London, and then we're going to go to Spain and Morocco. And so I wondered if you had any advice for us or what you saw.
All right. Now, are you going to Spain first and then Morocco?
Yes.
All right. Are you going to be coming back through England?
Yes. From Morocco, we'll go back to London.
Good. Okay. And how long are you going to have in London on your return?
Probably a week.
I'll tell you what I'm getting in my mind. I think you are going to enjoy Spain. I think you're going to enjoy Morocco. But for some reason, London is absolutely going to be alive with activity. And there are going to be some particular plays that will be on. And if you have the opportunity to find out about them, and if you're going to be in London for a week after Morocco, I'd encourage you to go to these performances.
Okay.
And I'm seeing two or three that you'll have an opportunity to see, because I think they're just going to be exquisite. And there's when you go into England, it's feeling a little bit cool, and I feel a little chilled. You need to, I think, be aware of the fact you need some rest. And make sure when you're traveling that you're drinking plenty of fluids. I'm not so concerned about food. I'm concerned more about fluids. You're being dehydrated. And my eyes are burning. I'm feeling very, very tired. So rest is important after you get to England. And if you can just sort of have a day down, if that is possible, before you fly to Spain, that will make your time in Spain much more enjoyable. But boy, you need good walking shoes. And you need comfortable shoes. There is a need, because of a little bit of socializing that I'm seeing you doing, there's going to be a need of maybe having one outfit, like one dress, a very basic style dress, that you could dress up or dress down. But again, I'm sort of feeling chilly, so I don't know what it is going to be. I'd carry something like a London fog, maybe with a liner on the inside of it, so that if I needed that little bit of extra warmth, that would really come in handy. And I'm feeling some dampness, too. So
okay.
I think all of that together is very, very significant. But I do think you're going to enjoy Morocco. Now, what fascinates me is that I think you're going to enjoy the people more than you enjoy the environment. Oh, my goodness, I just looked at my clock. E, I'm going to have to go, dear. We're out of time.
Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Give us a buzz and let us know how the trip is.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, time goes so fast when you're having fun. I'm so delighted to have shared this hour with you. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Jolene Corbin about medical misfits. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a great one. Talk to you tomorrow.